Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Ideas Sin. I'm your host, Denise, and today I'm excited to present to you Yankel. So Yankel and I met at a Krav Maga MMA gym out in Boston. It's been a few years now, right?
It's been a few years.
Yeah.
It's been about 3 years.
Yeah. Oh, man. How long have you been going to Ali's gym?
I think by the time you joined the gym, how long were you there, actually?
Oh, I think close to a year, maybe.
Okay. I'd probably been coming about 6 years, 6 or 7 years by then.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So had you been fighting that entire time, or like what got you into Krav Maga and MMA and Muay Thai?
So I had always wanted to do martial arts. Mm-hmm. That was like a passion of mine when I was a little kid. I never had the opportunity to, only to fight with my sisters and do pretend karate. And then I was kind of a wild child, so I definitely fought a lot as a kid and in my like late teens. And I'd always get the shit kicked out of me. That was like a common theme. I enjoyed fighting. It was like, I didn't enjoy beating people up. I just kind of enjoyed the challenge. And, but I rarely won, you know, in a significant way. And then I was living in Boston. I was working as a chef and I'd moved and I saw the gym nearby, and I felt like this need for an outlet of some sort. I was working all day, all night, every day. And it was, you know, a high stress environment, and I just needed something to let off steam. So I walked into the gym and joined it. It's funny, I remember Ali, the owner of the gym, telling me that he hated me when he first met me.
Really?
Because I swaggered in there with like boots and a leather jacket. And yeah, he's like, well, who's this guy? I'm going to kick his ass. I'm going to beat him within an inch of his life. Which he did lovingly many, many times. I joined the gym and went whenever I could while I was working.
Yeah. I mean, did that ever tire you out? Because you have the high stress work environment. So you're putting out a lot of energy already. And then obviously getting into martial arts, you're exerting a lot of energy too. And then having to deal with recovery time. Like, did that ever tire you out, or did it end up energizing you, or what was that like?
It was definitely a push at first. I would say there was a lot of pre-workout and Red Bull involved. In terms of like, I would go in the afternoons or like early evening when I could get out of the restaurants for a little bit, and then go back to work after the class to do whatever I had to do for the rest of the day. And and I was also like fairly overweight at the time when I joined the gym. And so it was an absolute struggle. But I slept well, which was, you know, the great benefit of it. And the more consistently I went and the more consistently I exercised, I definitely, it turned around. It became a big source of energy. And I learned how to be more efficient with my exercise. Knowing that I had to go back to work, I could put a particular amount of energy into a class. And if we were fighting or sparring that class, I wouldn't, you know, I can't back down and I can't not go 100%, but I had to learn how to make my 100% efficient.
Mm. Yeah.
So, but yeah, the energy that I got from it was tremendous.
Yeah. I mean,
and I really, yeah, go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I really reached a point where, it was kind of all I wanted to do. I started to write my schedule around the gym instead of just finding time to go to the gym. And eventually it was definitely sort of the success that I was having at the gym and in martial arts in general and fighting was a catalyst for me leaving my career at the time to really for the sake of being able to train full time.
Yeah. And so how was it training full time?
So I quit my job as a chef because I just want to go to the gym all the time and train. And a lot of like interesting things happened. First thing that happened was like, I'm kind of a vivid dreamer and
same.
Yeah, historically I would lose fights in my dream or have like feelings of helplessness. Those vanished. And the more I trained and the more I pushed myself, the more that like confidence just translated to the rest of my life. And particularly like, stressful situations or, dangerous situations or sort of anything that, that gets your heart rate up, I had the opposite reaction after a while where anything was manageable. I could take on anything. It was really, it felt like a lesson in just life management. If you can manage like a 3-minute spar with someone who's dangerous, and you can pretty much manage anything. So, training all the time was fantastic. You know, after a little while of being jobless, I realized I had to, it was time to start making some money. So, I started teaching at the gym. So I started teaching fitness classes in the morning. We launched a 6 a.m. fitness class. So I would run the fitness class at 6 a.m. And then I did a noon class, which didn't usually have a lot of people, but people that came were dedicated. So it was a good class. And then would train for, then I would, now I was really focused on like being able to, on just like supporting my training. So like weights and kind of HIIT exercises. So I'd do that like an hour before classes started in the evening and then do about 2 hours of training and then do my own workout at the very end of it. And then I looked for other opportunities. So I think I called Tufts, just kind of cold called them and said, do you have a Krav Maga or a self-defense program there? And they were like, no. And I was like, do you want one? They're like, great. So I started teaching self-defense for credit at Tufts.
Nice.
Which was, it was awesome. It was a great experience. I did that for 4 or 5 years.
Okay. And you mean credits like school credits or?
Yeah, it was a 1-credit class.
Oh, interesting. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always full. I had like 30 students every semester.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And then I would do the Tufts orientation. So they incorporated a self-defense seminar for the incoming athletes. It was part of their orientation. So I did it last year. They still call me every year to come back and do it.
That's awesome.
Nice. Yeah.
And so you were... You started teaching classes and prior to that you did your own workouts, but how much did that affect your growth in your own training? Because now it's like you're working, but as soon as you start focusing on teaching, like you're not necessarily getting the same output or maybe input as you would if you were just training full time. Like how did that affect your performance in the sport?
So there's an up and down there. The up is a lot of the sort of intricacies of like martial arts development, and this definitely applies to everything, but when you start to teach it, you have to think about it in a totally different way, and you have to break it down differently. And even if it's something that like you've been doing sort of just, you know, someone showed you, you know, jab cross, right? And then you go and do it over and over, but you're not really thinking particularly about all the fundamentals and all of the muscle movement and all of the, you know, body dynamics that go into doing it properly and technically. And then ask someone to explain exactly how it works and why it's effective. And most people wouldn't be able to answer it clearly, but if you're going to teach a class, you have to be able to explain it. So for me, it was a piece of like the why of everything and not just the how, which has always interested in me. I'm always looking to like understand to the extent that I can, you know, I can see the how, I can see like what it's supposed to be. But understanding the why for me is, just gets me to the next level. But it's true. Now I'm teaching classes, not taking classes. So at some point, that's why I'd supplemented with as many of my own workouts as I could. And I would find, you know, training partners in the gym who also were down for extra exercise, and we would do our own thing. After a period of time, I kind of plateaued in my own advancement, and particularly after, you know, 7 years, and then I earned a black belt. At that point, I was just teaching, and I think I'd definitely gotten another job at that time, so I was working and didn't have as much free time as I wanted. Which is kind of what led me into Muay Thai. I'd always kind of done Muay Thai along with Krav, but focused a lot on Krav, just because of its practicality and its violence and its weapons based, and it was just a lot more fun. And like, you know, the 2-on-1, 3-on-1, 4-on-1, et cetera, fighting, is a totally different challenge. When I plateaued, I was like, okay, well, I have this other martial art that I've always loved, that I'm interested in, that I can now attack as far as like continuing to grow, something new to learn. And, sometimes, I mean, for me, that took me to another gym, to meeting a different crowd, to another gym where I wasn't like, you know, more advanced than a lot of the people. Especially when it came to Muay Thai, I was, you know, lower third most of the time in terms of ability and all of that. So that was, I plateaued for a bit. It was like 6 months before I was like, shit, I'm getting fat again. I'm not getting anything out of this. I'm just hanging out and talking to people. I'm teaching classes, but like the extent that that's a workout is sort of questionable, and it's way more on me to be motivated to work my hardest when I don't really have to. So I had to go find another group of people, another place where, I was just, you know, a student there basically.
Yeah. And then did those new classes influence the way that you taught your ongoing classes and even future classes?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I left with like a whole new curriculum in my hands. A different way of coaching, because different coaches, everyone, you know, teaches things differently. And I was really lucky, throughout all of my martial arts experiences to work with like highly talented teachers. And, I don't think I could have like continued if I wasn't getting a really good education, and if I didn't see coaches really understanding what they were doing, why they were doing it, And I found, particularly with high level coaches, they have this like uncanny ability to change your, you know, training trajectory. If you're like slowly growing like that, a really good coach, and you've put the work in, but you're halfway up the hill, a really good coach is in one session is going to make that happen. Just the smallest, they'll pick up on what you're able to change. Like a martial arts coach isn't going to be like, well, if you do a split right now, you know, you're going to rock this. They see what your ability is, and they see the one thing that you can change immediately to make you grow exponentially. Mm. And those are, I've experienced that not just with martial arts, but like with drumming, with cooking, you know, encounter a great coach or a great teacher somewhere, and I know from that one thing that they're someone worth learning from.
Yeah. So somebody who's new to either martial arts or literally any other area, how can they tell if it's a good coach? Because if you're completely new and you're just like, I don't know what I'm doing here, like, how can you tell if that's going to be a good coach for you versus somebody who is just kind of regurgitating everything else that they see either on TV or just from observing other people?
That's a good question. The retro of that. So afterwards you have something in your head and you're like, or you have this like aha moment. It's definitely a sign of a good coach, but, in the moment, it's going to be a question of like, did they pay attention to you in particular? Did they break it down in a way that you understand it? Something like as simple as if you're brand new to martial arts and you're just learning a fighting stance, solidifying that fighting stance is crucial. So really like looking at somebody's posture, looking at how they walk, how they hold themselves, and then adapting your lesson to their like physicality, is an experience you should have, and good coaches will give that to you. Good coaches will typically, like what I used to do, and this is drawn from the great coaches that I had, is tell someone to walk. And people get, you know, really stiff when you put them in a position if they're not familiar with, you know, martial arts or like even like physical like sports, if they're not particularly athletic or they haven't done anything in a long time, they'll get stiff, and they'll be really focused on like an exact like perfect symmetry of, you know, or trying to mimic somebody else. And what I would do is like have people walk and be like, hey, you notice how you're swinging your arms when you walk, like you're kind of loose, you're not like like marching along.
Yeah,
right. And then put them back into a fighting stance and be like, remember, it's just walking, you're literally just walking, you're just walking a little bit differently. Mm. And that's kind of a baseline that puts it into perspective for people. It makes it really easy to access. And another thing is giving people homework. I've been to a lot of gyms and it's just like class is over, people walk out, even if there are a lot of new people there. But I always try to give homework, something to go home and practice. Because if it was a good class and people had a good experience, they walk out excited about it, and you want to keep that excitement. You want them to really have enjoyed what they're doing and to be able to go home and show it off, right? Like, it's a big, big piece of martial arts as it's taught in schools is performance. So there should be an element of performance to it. You should think you look cool doing it. You know, when you get into like high level self-defense, you know, that it's the opposite. It goes back to like total humility and hiding your abilities and being super efficient with your movements instead of flashy. But there has to be, like a high level of enjoyment for people to keep going with it. You got to feel really good about what you're doing. It has to feel effective. You can't, if you walk out of a gym and you're like, well, I'm never going to be able to kick that high, so like, this isn't for me, then I would say that the coach didn't do a good job. You should walk out feeling like, this is something I can definitely do. And even if I can't kick as high as the flexible person next to me, I can modify my attacks to my body. They're still going to be fluid. They're still going to be powerful. They're still going to be efficient, and I'm going to feel really good doing them.
Yeah. So as a coach and trainer, instructor, does it get overwhelming to focus on all those little idiosyncratic movements or fundamentals for people? So for example, like, let's say you have a class of 30, like, are you picking something up for all 30 of those students, or do you end up focusing on the ones who like really need the help? Or how do you kind of balance that out? How do you navigate like who to help the most versus, oh, you know, critiquing every single person?
So the Tufts class is a great example of how I had to answer that question, because in the gym that we were training at, you'd have people that had come all the time, and you have new people walking through the door. So it's a lot easier to say, you know, I can focus on the people that have been here already kind of know what they're doing. I can add, you know, teach something new, give it to everyone, and then help the newer people get some fundamentals down. But the Tufts class, I was basically starting from scratch every semester. And I would ask people, you know, who here has martial arts experience? And then I would just say, forget what you know for now. And teach, you know, really basic fun, like the fundamentals go from, I think in the first class I would do, you know, fighting stance, jab cross, and some movement with it. So you could, you know, move your feet while you were punching. And I think what I realized over time was, rather than, I mean, I would demonstrate it, and I would walk you through like the step one, step two, step three of it, but teaching the like why you do that is something that like everyone can pick up. And for like, it's funny, people would come in to the gym or to these classes and I could see right away that they're like, they have complete natural talent or they have no talent at all and are going to need a little bit of extra care. And so, but the why of it doesn't require you to do anything except like think, okay, you know, turning my hand over when I punch, so all the way from my shoulder, my elbow, my wrist, all of that gives me like a little bit more extension. And the looser my shoulder is, the faster my fist is going to get to my target. And the more I turn it over, the more, the closer I get to it. And so these are like the little kind of details that, instead of just saying, you know, left punch, right punch, that everyone's going to be thinking about. And then it makes it a little bit easier. But I would definitely focus on the people who weren't doing it as well. And I try to pair them up with people who are better at it, you know, so automatically you put, which some people find frustrating while they're in the class, but you get to move people around a lot, but you put the people who are not performing as well with people who are, who either have more experience or have picked it up right away, and you make them work together. That's like a big piece of both of their advancements as students, because you know, I'd have people who were afraid to get hit, who like just were uncoordinated physically, or badly out of shape, and put them with someone who's just like a natural born athlete who's been coming to the gym for like 2 years, who's a little bit wild, and force them to work together at a pace that is great for both of them. And sometimes like the person who's just there to like get wild and go crazy for an hour, like I'd have to talk to them about, you know, dialing it back and being way more disciplined and taking the opportunity when they have to go slower to really focus on the fundamentals and getting and the technique and making it perfect. So yeah, it was just it was always a challenge getting people to buy into that, but bottom line is I think it was extremely valuable.
So the students, did you see any students that were totally just completely off? Again, one of those people who were just not athletic or just really awkward. Like, how often are they sticking to a sport like this versus them just dropping off and being like, I can't do this. I can't physically figure out the right natural movement.
So I think, I mean, one of the things that's special about Krav is that it is designed for anybody. It doesn't require a high level of physicality to master the basics. And it definitely doesn't require a high level of coordination. It's really structured for anybody to learn quickly. And so there's that like question of, you know, do I keep correcting this person just because they're like not doing something perfectly, or do I just kind of let them go? It was a question I thought about a lot because, as a chef, I made a commitment to never walk past anything that was wrong. And that's kind of the job. It's like, not even the smallest detail am I going to walk by and just be like, oh, like they left their knife, you know, off on the cutting board again, like that. Like, no, every time you got to stop and say something. And, I had to, so I brought that into my coaching as well, where it's like, if I see someone doing something wrong that I think is either dangerous for them or dangerous for their partner, and obviously I'm going to say something. If I see somebody doing something that's like not exactly the technique we're doing, but it's close enough and it's effective and they're putting all their effort into it, then I'm not going to overcorrect. Because the main thing about Krav is that you know how to defend yourself as much as possible. And that you, you know, bring all the violence whenever it's necessary. Mm. So provided that's the spirit that they have, you know, they could be really bad at it, but as long as they're putting all their effort in and they kind of get what they're doing and why they're doing it, then I'm going to make them feel good about it. And also try and give them opportunities to show off their strengths, whether that's like a particular drill or a particular partner who's going to like let them work, you know, their way. So I would say over the years, I've had a lot of people, I've had more people drop out who think they knew everything than I've had people drop out who are bad at things but try hard.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I guess I kind of see that too. Just people are like, yeah, I'm just too good. I got this. It's like, no, oh, you can still get a few more lessons in. Yeah,
exactly. It's those people are the first time like somebody who doesn't appear to be as great at it as them takes them apart. They're usually done. It's an ego check right there. Yeah. And the ones who show up the next day are the ones who stay for a really long time. Hmm.
And so what about injuries? Like, I'm sure you've had to deal with injuries fighting. And I remember Ali and even you just mentioning how you guys used to get thrown into the closet or something to fight.
We went all out. We went all out as in like, yeah, a big closet, four or five people, baseball bats, dull metal knives, heads through walls. I honestly walked out with so many concussions. I broke my nose there at least like four times. I broke toes in the course of training and fighting. I've broken every knuckle on both hands. I've broken ribs. Twisted my ankles, knee surgery, hip surgery. I wouldn't chalk it all up to fighting. I did spend like 15 years on my feet as a chef, bent over. So like my body is, beat it up many different ways, but like, I mean, that also goes back to the coaching and the atmosphere and your training partners. The idea is to like, I always thought this is another kind of food reference, but I love spicy food, and I was down for like a pepper challenge or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of made the distinction between pain and damage. So I kind of applied that to fighting and martial arts as well, where like, you know, the first time you get punched in the face, it shouldn't be in a dangerous situation. It should be with someone wearing a padded glove in a gym, but like you should still get punched in the face. And yeah, your eyes are going to smart and you might have a bruise. But you survive it and, you know, you can still go on with your life, pretty much as normal. And that's, I think an important part of the training. It's also, you know, managing the injuries, it was pretty rare that I wasn't able to come and train the next day, no matter what the injury was. And because I was interested in training a lot, I would find something to do. Like even with a twisted ankle, I could still find an exercise that I could manage, even if it's just standing in one place and working on a single punch over and over. Broken ribs, that took me out of the game for like a few weeks. But as much as possible, it's just, you know, find something else to do. But really, like, a good coach will make sure that doesn't happen, just by how they teach it, how they explain, you know, how to be cautious, who they pair people with. You shouldn't leave. Injuries are inevitable in Krav Maga training. They're bound to happen, and you're definitely going to get bruised up. But that's the nature of it. And the goal is to do it in a safe environment so that if it ever happens elsewhere, it's not going to stop you. You're familiar with it. You can think through it. You're not shocked when you get punched or kicked, or when something is like overwhelmingly aggressive or in your face. You know, that's all stuff that you train for. The training should be as realistic as possible. Yeah. Just, you know, health insurance helps.
Yeah, it does. I mean, have you had any students that got injured and then just never came back to the sport?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had a kid lose a toe.
Ooh, really?
Entirely, yeah, fully like de-sleeved, big toe, like it was, I have a picture of it. It came all the way off and it's just the little bone sticking out.
There was a girl when we were in there too. She did something and I think something happened with her toe too. It's not that person, right?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. He did it to himself too. He just went to kick and was so like committed to the kick. He dragged his toe on the mat and it just came right off.
Gross. I'd still want to see the picture.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. He goes, I just hear him go, ankle. And I'm like, dude, what? And then I turn around and he's like, my toe. And it's hanging off just by a tiny little piece of skin. It's barely bleeding. Mm. And I'm like, all right, we'll get you an ambulance. but hang on, I gotta go grab my phone so I can take a picture of this. I've never seen this before. he didn't come back.
Yeah.
And from time to time, if it was an injury that would keep you out of the gym for a bit, often that would lead to someone not coming back. Especially if it's early on in their training, like busted ribs. Kids these days are really worried about their heads. So like concussions for new students, that like they'd go to the doctor and the doctor would be like, you can't get hit in the head for the next 6 months and you really should never get hit in the head. And that'd be that.
So there
are injuries that definitely stop people from coming. But I think for the most part, if you're clear on your goals and you're there for a reason, Krav Maga in particular is one of those things that there aren't tournaments. Mm. You're not going to get a ring fight for Krav Maga. At its base, its functionality is purely hand-to-hand combat, self-defense. And if that's why you're there, then an injury is not going to stop you. You're going to recover and figure out, how to avoid those injuries in the future and then keep learning. I guess I'd compare it to if you get a bad grade in a course, you don't just drop the course, or you shouldn't. You're going to, go learn more. So it's important for the coaches for sure to establish, why people are there, for them to understand what they're in for, what they can get out of it.
Yeah. So do you find that your students' demographics have been changing over time, or do you find that there's a particular type of person that usually goes to take these classes? And obviously that's going to vary with the Tufts course that you teach, but for all of the other courses that you've taught, was it a type of personality or type of person that would typically show up, or is it just pretty mixed?
That's interesting, because I also taught for community security services. So teachers, schools, synagogues, community centers. I would do classes for the staff there. Either to be able to manage unruly kids or participants, or for identifying bigger threats, and being able to manage those. So in the case of the gym, it was usually, given its location, it was either students, a lot of young professionals, particularly in hospitals, so nurses and not so much doctors. I feel like they're a step removed from the riffraff, but definitely nurses and caregivers. And then usually people came in with a particular reason. Either they had been attacked in the past, they felt like they were at risk for some sort of physical abuse, or they were in a volatile environment. People came in with specifics, and that I would, without, pressing people too much and getting into their personal lives, if they didn't want to, I would try to understand why they came in. And then the community services, we get a lot of older people in the community, empty nesters who are we want to be able to defend ourselves, but we don't necessarily want to own guns. We want to learn how to be able to be physically effective in any circumstance. Definitely have to, I'd go from teaching a bunch of athletic 18-year-olds at Tufts to teaching a bunch of retirees in the same day. Hmm. And it's not the same class that you teach.
Yeah. So with that, do you find that even between men and women, do you find that there would be more women then going into Krav for self-defense versus men? Maybe they would opt in for more Muay Thai or something, or did that not really matter?
It didn't really matter. I think it was usually a pretty even split in terms of like the general population. And there were always like guys in there who wanted to fight. And so like Krav is good for getting you in shape and for teaching you like legal but dirty tricks, or exposing you to like a style of fighting that's maybe more aggressive than Muay Thai even. But often if that was their goal, they would transition into like a sanctioned fight sport and just focus on that after a while. And I didn't see a lot of that with women going into like sport fighting. They generally tended to stay in the self-defense sphere, but it was pretty evenly split, which was good because there isn't a high level of like woman on woman violence statistically. And so, as far as like realistic training goes, best case scenario is women fighting men who are bigger and stronger than them for the sake of really learning, which did kind of make it difficult sometimes, because if there were more women than men in the class, then, you know, pairing a 6'2" guy who's 250 pounds with a 90-pound, 5-foot woman, it doesn't give the big guy a lot to do. Which is a great opportunity for them to work on their particular fundamentals and techniques and to learn how to be gentle.
Yeah, I definitely had that issue too. There was sometimes we were like grappling and I was like, I just can't move. So how did that like affect your training or your coaching, like women and versus men, because like obviously there's things that you have to accommodate for, and I'm sure you had to like figure out new ways to approach different techniques or stances and even strategy, I would say, because if you can't use your physical body to outmaneuver or physically fight somebody off, like I'm assuming you have to also like think your way out of certain things. So how did that affect your coaching?
So I was really fortunate before I ever started training seriously, to have met one of the top Israeli Defense Force combat coaches. She was a woman about your size, who taught the advanced, like the elite units, hand-to-hand combat. And I remember just like being flabbergasted and also like working with her a little bit and being on my ass constantly. Just before I knew it, I was down and dead. So I had a little bit of this, like, and I didn't remember too much about what she taught me. And I started coaching years later. But I had this idea that, like, you know, obviously anything is possible. We're going to figure it out. So it's a problem you have to solve for, right? It's like, all right, a quarter of the body weight and half the size. How do you manage it? And a lot about it is, you know, it's using your head. It's also a piece of that is just before, if possible, if there's a moment before someone puts hands on you, to run, negotiate your way out, you know, anything like that. Once you've exhausted all possible, you know, talk your way out of it or run away opportunities, you have to start using that person's strength against them. And that would be like the basis of how I would manage coaching. And really it was looking at the people in front of me and saying, okay, like, wait, there are ways that you can drop this person who's twice your size. I'm going to show you. And it really takes one time doing it effectively for the smaller, lighter person to like feel tremendous amount of confidence and to be able to do it over and over. Like, and it's really, it goes back to the why you do something. Like, I can't just be like, grab your wrist, turn around, hook under their arm, you know, sweep their feet. Like, conceptually, if that bigger person's not doing anything, that will work. You'll be able to flip them. But if they start struggling, then it's game over. Unless you understand what you're doing, why you're doing it. And then it's like, well, if they move, they're in that moment of movement, slightly off balance. You know, if they take a step, that's 1 foot off the ground, one less foot I have to deal with. And you know, the leverage of like your body weight against theirs, taking out their center of gravity, doesn't require more mass or strength. It just requires you to focus on what you're doing and use what you got. And that was a great, I mean, I loved those challenges. I loved finding ways that you would think like, oh, that person will never have a chance against that other person, and finding a way for them to beat them up.
Yeah. So with Krav and Muay Thai, like there's a lot of focus and discipline that has to go into learning all of these different things, and including coaching. I mean, there's a lot to learn there just on how to interact with people and how to communicate a certain point. And so for you, how did that translate into other parts of your life? So for example, you noted you were a chef. So we could even dive into that story a little bit and be like, what got you into cooking?
It's funny. So I got into cooking because I didn't, I was a terrible student in school, and I also didn't want to go to college. So senior year of high school, instead of a senior project, I got a job at a restaurant. And it was something I took to very naturally. Either I started as a waiter, and like I just organized things in my head immediately. So like I never got overwhelmed. I had a good memory. I was engaging. I liked the high pressure. Like the busier it was, the more I enjoyed it. And eventually I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, how this happened. As I worked as a waiter and a bartender and a front of house manager and a bunch of other things that didn't involve cooking for a while, and then answered a job for a sous chef position and totally lied about my experience and went to work in a kitchen with a group of people, none of whom spoke English, and I didn't speak Russian or Portuguese at the time. And I learned, and it was a busy, tiny little kitchen, and they taught me everything while I was there. I didn't care at all about food. I didn't care about like cooking techniques per se. I liked the physicality of cooking in a busy kitchen. And so I kind of treated it as a dance. And I focused for a long time just on being super efficient with my movements. Whether that was cutting things with a knife or sauteing or cleaning a walk-in refrigerator, like whatever it was. For me, it was a focus on like identifying all the steps right in front of me as quickly as possible, and then doing it physically as fast as possible in the best way that I could. And over the years, like I grew in the restaurant industry. I stayed in the kitchen after that forever. And I worked in the busiest kitchens in Boston. I worked in one restaurant that was 750 seats next to Fenway Park. We would serve 3,500 people in 3 or 4 hours before the game. And if you weren't perfect with every movement physically, like, never mind, like, you know, the beef mix that went into the burger or like the seasoning or any of that, like, nobody, like, someone else's job, mm-hmm. you know, the cooking job at the time for me was just make it perfect every time and do it in like vast quantities at high speed. And it was purely physical. And that for me definitely translated right into martial arts. It was just like, you know, you make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you're fucked. And if you don't practice the like minute movements, then you're not going to be able to do it again the next day because whatever, you're going to cramp or you're going to injure yourself, or you know, in the kitchen you're going to get cut, you're going to burn, bad things are going to happen, or you're going to get fired because you just, you know, if you're at that level of pressure and volume, you know, you mess up one item and you're behind and that's it, and then the whole kitchen is going to fall behind because of that. So for me, I put that right into martial arts. But the cooking, like, it was the disciplines that I would practice for a long time were very specific to movement, to like being able to spin in a, you know, a tight circle, and deciding whether I'm spinning to my left or to my right for whatever reason, and moving like, you know, next to people, not banging into them, having, you know, your head's on a swivel the whole time. It's like you have to be seeing and hearing and remembering everything, thinking three steps ahead. It's a lot of physicality and a lot of practice. And I would challenge myself by like taking on things I didn't really know well, and crash and burn often. And then figuring out exactly what I did wrong and then working on that. I worked at a restaurant called Eastern Standard.
Oh yeah.
So it's right near Fenway Park. And one day I was working, salad station. Maybe I was still shucking oysters. I don't remember. The chef was like, anyone here know how to make eggs? And I'm just like, yeah, I know how to make eggs. Like, I make eggs for myself at home. Like, I don't know exactly what you're asking, chef, but it can't be that difficult. So the next day I was on the brunch station, and I had actually never, I'd maybe poached one egg at a time before. Mm. And this is like a 300 seat restaurant, and it was like flat sat the moment they opened for business, and it would stay like that for 4 or 5 hours, especially on weekends with like a 1 p.m. baseball game. So after I destroyed the poaching water and just massacred any number of omelets, chef kicked me off the line. He was like, get the fuck out of my kitchen. So I left and I went to Brookline Booksmith, the bookstore, and bought the Culinary Institute of America, their basic cookbook, textbook actually, and read the chapter on poaching eggs, and bought like 6 dozen eggs and went home and poached them all one after another to the point where I could do it in my sleep. I did that with a lot of things where, you know, I would figure out exactly what my weakness was, what my shortcoming was, or what knowledge I didn't know particular to that one thing, and then do it until I could do it in my sleep. And I definitely approached like Muay Thai the same way, and Krav, but I'm thinking more about Muay Thai just because the sport is also judged on your technique. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's judging your Krav technique necessarily. You know, if someone, even in belt like tests, like you're testing for a rank, you know, if someone points a gun at you and you get the gun away from them, you pretty much passed the gun part. whether you did it exactly perfectly, unless you're going on to be an instructor or something, it doesn't matter that much. But Muay Thai, like a lot of it is technique. And it's also an ancient martial art. And so it's important to, you know, represent the martial art the way it's supposed to be. So that's where I like really went back to that, like perfecting a technique. Like I could spend a whole day just working a jab. And then, you know, have to video myself and then redo it again, until it looked perfect. It didn't just like work. It was actually, pretty.
And so how did your knife skills improve when you started doing Krav and cooking?
It's funny. I have pretty good knife skills. Definitely had to, you know, restrain myself from like handing the busboy a steak knife and being like, stab me. Go ahead. Dare you.
He's like, what is going on?
Yeah, often. Honestly, everything improved. Yeah. I would say martial arts training is kind of one of the best things that you can do for yourself as far as exercise goes. Just because it's mental gymnastics as well. I mean, you have to think about it. You should always be, you're not just challenging yourself. Someone is always challenging you. And that's the kind of the point of like the fighting and sparring, is that, you know, there's a force in front of you that you can't just stop by like closing your eyes or getting off the bike or something. Like, it's going to keep coming until you stop it. And it's fun. When I was first training, I stopped doing this after a while, but like I would just go home and think of outrageous combos. And then like I'm going to do a 17 hit combo. That makes absolutely no sense. But like, I would just think about it all. I'm like, well, it should make sense. Even if it made sense logically, like, you know, the intentionality, like the jab across, there's a purpose to throwing the two punches one after another, right? And I would just work off of that. So like each punch should lead to a reaction, which leads to your next strike, which leads to a reaction, which leads to your next strike. And it's a chess game. And that's how I would often describe it as a coach to people, which is that you have to be thinking four moves ahead. And sometimes and typically, because if you try to respond when the attack is already coming, you're generally going to be too late. And so it's a lot about anticipation, and it's about putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, and you know, not closing your eyes when someone's trying to hit you, but like meeting whatever's coming your way head on. That's really about Krav too. It's not a defensive martial art. It's an offensive martial art. And the idea is always to, you know, double down on what, or triple down on whatever's coming at you.
And so with cooking, so you've had a few transitions. So you stopped cooking and then you got into Krav. What kind of kept you cooking on the side? Like, you still cook for yourself, or like, did you leave that passion, or what did you end up doing with it after you took a break from it and diving into Krav?
So I quit the restaurant business with like a strong promise to myself that I would never go back into the food industry. I was just really burnt out at the time. But then, you know, financially, I had to make more money than I was making as a coach. So I started a catering business. And I did a lot of catering for a while, which I really enjoyed, just because there's no surprises typically. If you're doing a good job, it's very it's structured, it's all pre-planned. Money's better. I really enjoyed it. So I got to do that for a while. And then I went to work for ButcherBox as the head chef, which was this direct-to-consumer meat company. And one of my responsibilities there was cooking education. Mm. So it was basically I'm stepping back into coaching shoes, but for food. And it was really interesting. It was kind of a similar experience because I knew how to do a lot of things in the kitchen. You know, I'd been cooking for 15 years at really high levels. So like there wasn't a lot that I didn't know. But I had never tried to explain it out loud to somebody before. Like I didn't hire people with no experience typically unless they really presented themselves as somebody who could learn rapidly and had a passion for it. But most of the time I'm not telling, you know, my new grill cook how to make a burger and why.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest thing is like, well, why do I do it that way? And for me, like, you know, there's 8 million ways you can cook a burger. If I'm going to teach somebody how to make a burger, number one, I have to like talk to them and, you know, what they have. Like not everybody has, you know, an Argentinian grill that's wood fired.
Maybe
it's just a nonstick skillet, right? Yeah. Same. So I have to apply, you know, what makes a really good burger to, you know, the circumstances. And I have to be able to make the burger and talk about it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, it was essentially the same experience, but in a new medium, where it was something that I was pretty good at. And now I had to do it and explain it at the same time and do it, you know, efficiently, in a short amount of time. The explanation had to be efficient and to the point. Like I can ramble on about making a burger for hours, but nobody's going to watch more than 5 minutes. So I got to be able to do it in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. In a way that I feel really good that the person, whoever is, you know, absorbing this material is going to be able to then execute it on their own. And that was an awesome challenge, but it also kept me cooking, just from a totally different perspective. And, it was a learning curve for sure. I went in with a lot of like restaurant concepts that just don't make any sense in the home kitchen. So I had to like relearn basically how to cook at home. Which was awesome. But every now and then I would get a chance to like go back into chefing, would do like big events where I got, you know, it wasn't just cooking our products, but it was really like telling stories with food and using all sorts of local ingredients depending on where we were, or creating something that represented our company for different groups of people. So I still got to cook a lot. And now, you know, I cook at home pretty much every day. So.
And so what were like the primary differences between obviously restaurant cooking and then home cooking, aside from like the very obvious things like, yeah, you don't have like a full kitchen per se. You don't always have like the intense equipment or maybe all the spices, but like, were there any random like nuanced things that you were like, oh yeah, that's interesting. Like I never thought that would be a thing that would really impact your food.
The number one thing is temperature. Mm-hmm. Like nothing that you have in your kitchen at home gets as hot as things do in a restaurant. Your grill, no matter how good it is, no matter like it's not going to get as hot as a restaurant grill. Your stovetop is not going to heat up pans as hot as a restaurant stovetop will. There's a difference of like 15,000 to 20,000 BTUs right there. And so if you're teaching people to sear a steak, and even if you're making the comparison, like this steak's going to be as good as the one you get at like Capital Grill or whatever. You can't just like heat up your pan and pop it in there. You gotta like heat your pan up for 5 minutes, you know, it's gotta be like glowing red, if you're going to get the same experience. So that was, and then there kind of, I would discover ways around that, you know, making sure your steak is basically bone dry. So there's no moisture on it that like either lowers the pan temperature or evaporates and creates steam. Same thing with your oven. Like even if you turn your oven, an oven in a restaurant that's 500 degrees and an oven at home that's 500 degrees are not, they're not the same. And that might be a convection thing. It might be a heat element thing. It might be just an electrical thing. But the bottom line is that you're not working with the same temperature. So that was like one big thing that I had to work through. And then it's simple things like having a sheet pan with a resting rack, which like you'll always have in a restaurant for seasoning or for resting things. Nobody has at home. And so there's no point in using that as a technique. And so it's really about finding something that works equally well that everyone does have at home.
Yeah.
Timing was another thing. You know, there's a reason you can go to a restaurant and have like your entree in 15 minutes. And it's not realistic to like think you can put dinner on the table at home in 15 minutes, but there are still ways to make it efficient and to like think through the process and get your timing right and leave time for food to rest and have the right temperatures and still be hot when you eat it and all of that.
And did you find that your diet changed as soon as you learned more about cooking and also when you started training more?
Yeah. It's funny. For the majority of my career as a chef, I didn't eat well at home. Or I ate really simply. Like, I really lived on like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and ramen, Gatorade and Red Bull. Like, that was because I would also spend most of my day cooking and tasting rich food and like such a variety of it. And, my taste buds were, you know, just dead after a day at work. So it was really just like, I needed something simple and, nourishing to some degree. When I started training, that changed a lot for me. I had to like really focus on my protein intake, especially when I was working out like from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. relatively. So I had to make sure I was kind of getting everything I needed and wasn't just like evaporating by burning a ton of calories. And then when I worked for this meat company, I pretty much ate meat for like 6 years. Yeah. That was just standard. Now like taking all of these things that I've learned and all of these techniques and all of my knowledge, I have a pretty like structured diet. I mean, I do interesting, but it's just as far as proteins go. So it's like chicken or fish or some kind of meat. In all of them in moderation or vegetarian. And I just try to like play with it as much as I can. Again, I'm always looking to try and challenge myself, like happily grilling, over a fire pit in a snowstorm.
Yeah. That's actually kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and so as soon as your kind of diet and food intake changed, did you find that your interest in the kind of restaurants or places that you went to evolved as well?
Yeah. I don't have a lot of patience for subpar food. Mm-hmm. I like can't go to a lot of like the chain restaurants. Like I just won't do it.
Yeah.
If I do, honestly, the only thing I'm getting at like a TGI Fridays is mozzarella sticks. Like I'll get the things that I know exactly what I'm getting.
Yeah.
But in general, I try to find, I usually go to restaurants for the chef, not the food, or for what I can sort of glean about the chef by reading the menu. So I'm looking for like creativity and for maybe things that I haven't experienced before, certainly. To me, it's like a learning experience more than anything else. Comfort food wise, again, if I'm going to go to a grill or a barbecue place, they have to do it really well, and they have to do it the same way every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Austin has a ton of barbecue, but you've been here.
Yeah.
You've been here before, right?
Yep. I was there, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, actually.
Yeah.
At this point.
Did you go check out all the barbecue spots?
I sure did.
What was your impression of it?
Yeah. Some of them were really good. Some of them were mm-hmm. Tourist traps. Mm-hmm. I do remember getting some really good brisket somewhere along, was it 5th Street or something?
Oh, 5th or 6th Street. Know. Yeah, 6th Street is the party.
6th Street. Street. Yeah. Yeah. It was funny that our company was doing a ton of marketing in that area at the time, and I was wearing one of the sweatshirts, and a bunch of people recognized me, which was fun.
That's awesome.
Waiting in line for barbecue. I definitely want to go back and experience more of that. Good barbecue is more rare than people might think.
Really? And why do you think that is? Is it because of the process or because of the meat itself, or why is that?
It's a process that requires a lot of patience and a lot of experience. No one will make a good brisket the first time, period. It's impossible. You can follow the ingredients to a T,
yeah.
But the only way you make a good brisket is by fucking up a lot of them beforehand.
Yeah.
You really have to. It's one of those things where you because you're cooking with smoke for so much of it, temperature variance, and the wind, and the wood, and the meat, and the humidity in the air, and the moisture, and everything play a role that it's. It's almost unquantifiable, on paper. It's something you have to do by touch and look and experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Cooking is such an, I always love watching the cooking shows and Travel Channel, all of those things. And it's really amazing to see people's techniques and then even the judges' reactions to how they're eating the food. I mean, have you ever thought of maybe going on one of those shows, or what are your impression of those shows? Do you think those are real reactions, or what can you take off of those shows, for example?
Chopped comes to mind, mm-hmm. and I know and like a lot of the judges on Chopped. I would love to be a judge on Chopped.
Yeah.
That's a little dream of mine, yeah. For sure. I like the format of that, and I think the reactions typically are real. I think the dentist's office, I was watching Chopped Kids.
And it's hilarious. Yeah, the kids ones. Yeah.
They're so funny. It's great though. I couldn't imagine being that serious about anything when I was that age. And they're deadpan, really into their shit.
Well, you were serious about fighting when you were a kid.
Yeah. And it took me a couple of years to get there. It's true.
Yeah. I mean, and so it feels like you're one of those people that are very passionate about the things that you do. Clearly, you just dive into a lot of these different things. And I mean, how often do you find that you are chasing, you're exploring other avenues of either creativity or interests or hobbies? Do you find that you stick to one thing and then you hyper focus on that for however long your interest sticks to it? Or do you find that you find a few different things and then you kind of bounce around between them?
It's a mix of the two. Mm-hmm. I definitely tend to hyper focus on things when I'm really into it. But I'm not usually just into one thing. Mm-hmm. So I could be hyper focused on three things at a time. It was like that for training. When I was training martial arts, I was also doing firearms training, and I was also learning to play the drums. And those three things pretty much occupied me 100% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And you had trained me on that and helped me get my license. But I mean, was it Krav that got you into firearms? Or was it something else?
No, I always loved guns.
Yeah.
I spent a little time growing up in Israel, so there are soldiers everywhere. So I was kind of around guns a lot. And it was they just appealed to me. It could be movies, video games, whatever like pushed that along. Krav definitely was like the catalyst for it, for me like taking it seriously and training extensively and all that. Simply because the more serious I got about self-defense, the more I wanted to be able to defend myself against anything. And there's, you reach a point in self-defense where, punching isn't going to work against a gun. So It was kind of a natural next step.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. And so for anybody who's interested in diving into any of these activities, would you suggest that they research into it more, or to just like go to a class or a gym, or what would you suggest to people?
I would definitely say go to a gym that has a Krav Maga program. Start there. Two books that I read when I was coaching that I found really helpful. One was called Left of Bang.
Left of Bang.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. By Patrick Von Horn and Jason A. Riley.
Yeah. It's excellent about tapping into your natural fear and your like lizard brain, the hair on your neck stands up, being able to listen to that and identify why it's happening. So from like a self-defense standpoint, this is like avoidance at its best, or being ready for something. And the other one is called On Combat.
On Combat. Okay. Is that Lieutenant Colonel Dave something? I couldn't read.
Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman.
Oh, okay. The Psychology and Physiology of, what was it?
Deadly Conflict in War and Peace. Oh. Also awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So both give you like a good background in terms of like, what high level security and military minds are thinking about in volatile situations. Mm. And it's not just, accidental. It's very structured.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Quite so.
Yeah. Oh, well, Yanko, that's really awesome. Like anybody who's listening, I'll add that information into the bio so you can check it out yourself and check out the information in the library or Audible or Kindle, whatever you're fancy. But I mean, as we start to wrap things up, is there like any tips or final words of encouragement or advice that you have for our listeners?
One of the things that I encountered a lot, and I'm going to be completely honest, I kind of feel the same way myself sometimes, is that you have to be in shape to start martial arts. And like a lot of people will come like visit the gym and be like, okay, I'm going to go like get in shape and then I'll come back. Wrong. Do them simultaneously. And I'll feel the same way if I haven't been to the gym in a while. I'll be like, oh, I got to like, do some cardio for a couple weeks before I can start training again. Mm-mm. Get right into it. It doesn't matter size, shape, or like physical fitness level or anything. You can grow that just at the same time as you, start to feel better physically. And I would tell this to like cooks as well. Cooks would be like, oh, I'm gonna go to culinary school and then I'll come back. And I'm like, you're gonna get paid to work right now. And learn, like get paid to learn. And that's kind of like the thing in the gym is like, you're going to learn while you exercise. There's no reason you don't need to be anything except interested. And that's it. It's simple. The more interested you are and the more you learn, the easier it'll be to get into shape.
Yeah. No, it's true. I find that that's helped me with a lot of different sports too. I'm always encouraging people like, I've always told people like, find an activity that you just want to dive into. Like, don't always think like you have to go to the gym and do the same structured, oh, I got to do the fitness classes like everybody else is doing. It's like, find an activity or a sport, because sometimes that's much more engaging. You learn a lot more, and like, you don't feel like you're working out when you're enjoying the activity and you're learning. So yeah, I think that that's awesome. And so is there a particular site or any way that people can reach out to you or anything like that?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Chef Yankel. That would be the best place for the time being. When my company actually launches, I'll give you all the details.
Oh, yes. Ask a chef. Yes, I'd love that. And I'll share that as well too. I think by the time you launch it, I think this episode will, you know, come out. So I'll have all those details in there. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And to our listeners, thank you so much again for your time. I really appreciate everything. And Yankel, thank you so much for joining and, you know, sharing your experiences and everything that you've been through. I know that it was really fun to train with you, and like, there was a lot of like, I don't think I like bled, but I was going to say like blood, sweat, and tears when I was in training, but I don't think I bled. I don't think I cried in front of you guys either. I tried not to, but it was a lot of fun. And I appreciate your time and sharing things, and yeah, let me know how everything works out with the company. Okay.
I definitely will. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Pleasure. Good to see you.
Likewise. Thanks.